You are listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Hello and welcome to Prehistories. My name is Kim Bidulph and I'm fascinated by how we tell stories to each other all the time. And I'm especially fascinated, because of my background, about how we tell stories about prehistory. Today we're discussing a graphic novel called Mesolith that imagines the Mesolithic world of Northwest Europe and tells lots of stories about that. I'm talking to today Matt Ritchie, and the archaeologist of the Forestry Commission Scotland. Hello, Matt.
Hello.
I'm also talking to John Swagger, who we talked to on the last episode. He's an archaeological comic writer and illustrator himself. Hello, John.
Hello.
Hello. And those dedicated listeners of mine will also remember Erin Kavanagh, who is a geomythologist. Hello, Erin.
Hello.
Hi. Thank you so much, Erin. I know that you've got a little bit of a cough, so we will try and help you through this. I hope you've got something to drink whilst you're talking to us tonight. Sadly, Katie Whittaker, who is also a comic writer, couldn't join us tonight, which is a bit of a shame. But we'll have fun anyway, won't we?
Yes.
So, I wanted to ask John, were you a bit put out when Ben Haggerty and Adam Brockbank published this graphic novel?
Yes, I was. I really, really was. I was, because it was my idea first. And no, I think it's one of those ideas that was sort of kicking around at the back of my head when I first discovered that comics could do archaeology. And you think, yeah, you know, we could do this great mythological thing and set in prehistory and so on. And of course, I think that the thing that Mesolith really shows you is that there's a certain level of skill both in drawing and storytelling that you need in order to produce something like this. So although, yeah, I'm sure it was my idea first, there's absolutely no way on earth that I would be able to produce something like this, which is why it's so wonderful to see it.
It is. I mean, the biographies of the author and illustrator are pretty impressive, aren't they?
Yes.
With Ben Haggerty being a performance storyteller, and he tells lots of stories about lots of traditional folk tales, which I guess many of them are familiar to you, Erin.
Some of them are, yes. I'm great from spotting them.
Oh, yes.
Oh, what's that? I'm struggling to remember what they are. And yeah. That's always a job.
It is. It's quite good fun, actually, spotting all the evidence in here and the stories. And Adam Brockbank, who is the illustrator of this, has worked on is usually a storyboard artist for films, working on Star Wars and X-Men and Harry Potter and amazing things like that. So it is a pretty good looking book, isn't it?
It's good looking. And the really nice thing about it is to see people at that level wanting to put their skills in service of an archaeological story, which actually doesn't happen very often. Mm. I think Age of Bronze, I mean, from a comics point of view, Age of Bronze is the other one that immediately springs to mind, where somebody's prepared to put a huge amount of time and effort and real skill into something that essentially is relatively obscure.
It is, isn't it? Although, you know, it seems to be the Mesolithic of Northwest Europe does kind of capture people's imagination. I mean, Matt, you obviously worked quite closely with using Wolf Brother, which is a book that we talked about before, isn't it, by Michelle Paver, which is set in basically the same era in the same place, making and bringing out some of the ideas in that for teachers. Do you think you'd do the same thing for Mesolith? Does it do something different?
I think it does something really different. It is, as John says, graphic novel storytelling of the absolute highest caliber. So Ben Haggerty is, and I'm reading off the back of the biographies here, is an honorary professor of storytelling at the Arts University of Berlin. Mm-hmm. And Adam Brockbank has worked on all the Harry Potter films. These guys are grade A graphic novel storytellers. Mm. And the quality shines through. So, and I'm not sure it's the Mesolithic setting that makes the book. It's actually the quality of the storytelling. The Mesolithic is just the set, and it's quite a simple, quite an easily accessible set.
Do you think
but
so?
But it is just the set. Yeah, it's the storytelling, whether it be from Eastern European myth, whether it be from just from Ben's imagination, it's the stories themselves that shine through in this.
Yeah, because you're right, the Mesolithic is kind of a set. But do you think, Erin, do you think there's something special about that era that kind of captures our imagination? Or could it be set anywhere and weave all of these stories into it? Or any time?
I think the latter. I'm not sure how much it conveys Mesolithic information. I'm not saying it doesn't, but I agree that it's the quality of the storytelling and that captivates a reader more than the detail of the data, which is possibly the point.
I think
it sneaks in through the back door.
Yes, yeah. I mean, obviously, I think the most successful books that I've talked about that are set in prehistory are not driven by the evidence, they're driven by the story, and that is the way it just has to be. Now I should so let's talk I'm going to just kind of set the scene a bit more with the book and where it's set. It's supposed to be set in 10,000 years ago in Britain, and yet there are some interesting points in the story that where things have been brought from basically all over Europe. It's centered around a boy called Poika, that's how I'm going to pronounce it anyway, who's a bit of a risk taker, and he causes lots of problems and then kind of tries to get out of them as well. So he gets gored by a bull at one point, which is obviously pretty serious in the Mesolithic. It gets taken by a rival tribe. And then there are stories that other people tell him. The story, if you think it could be set anywhere, I think there is quite a lot of the Mesolithic, but it's in there's really small details, like there's a lovely dugout boat, for instance. There's a fishing spear, that's just been found complete with the bone prongs and the flint in the middle. That it kind of looks like a trident, really, I suppose. That features in there. There's Starkar antler frontlets, obviously, make a big part, and they're part of the hunting ceremony. I mean, did anyone else see anything what was the Mesolithic actually like, Matt?
I think it is as depicted within Wolf Brother, within Mesolith, and within things, books like The Gathering Night by Margaret Elphinstone. It's very much a tales of survival on the coastal fringe, or maybe in the wild woods, or indeed up in the uplands as well. And I think it's a set that lends itself to storytelling because it's so simple. It's almost like a desert island. It's something that people can pretty quickly grasp. And what's interesting about Mesolith is it started kind of slow with a hunting scene. And then starts to ramp up the cosmology of what these people might have believed. Mm. I think where the archaeology comes in, there are some really good parallels anecdotes that they've brought in from real archaeological discoveries. I think they sometimes drift a little, so there's a little bit of Paleolithic stuff in there, like the cave art.
Yes.
But I don't really mind that. And as long as you're not being overly worried about this being interpretation, about being factual, and you're quite happy with it being fictional, then the atmosphere that it gives of the Mesolithic, of what it must have been like to live in these small, tight family groups and to be continuously on the move and always thinking seasonally and about what you were going to be doing next month, whether you're doing that as a family group or whether you're meeting up as a tribal group, And it's a really good insight into the, what it must have been like in Mesolithic Europe.
Mm. I mean, I didn't get the sense that they moved around that much, actually. And obviously, we have got more evidence recently that people were staying still for maybe 100 years in the same spot, or at least some people staying there, like at Starkar or at Howick, where we've got houses that that stand for a very long time. So, I mean, I don't get the sense when I look at the evidence of the Mesolithic that's coming out that it actually was a period of just surviving. And as you say, as it comes out of the book, you do get out of Mesolith, you get a sense of that wider cosmology, particularly. I mean, one thing that really worried me was about how women are portrayed in this. And I know you're worried about that as well, Erin. And the Gathering Night was much, much better in terms of the representation of women's roles. What was it that, I mean, if you can describe, Erin, how it looks in this book to be a woman in the Mesolithic?
Oh, it's the Kardashians in the Mesolithic period, isn't it? it's women in bikinis making themselves beautiful, looking for husbands, learning certain skills at home, such as sewing. But they're not out hunting. For me, it spoils it.
I think
it's such a small detail that could have been done just slightly differently, which would have completely changed the way it feels to read from the perspective of female.
It's the one story in the book, I think the one you're talking about is when they find star husbands, that it goes beyond the realm of the Mesolithic set and it turns into complete fantasy fiction. And it really jars, it sticks in the throat, that one story. I really don't like it. But I agree with you.
The inclusion of the star wolf and the star fox is a stroke of genius, because you've got the star fox as a constellation in the northern hemisphere, and you've got the constellation of the wolf in the southern hemisphere. So that's a fantastic way of geographically situating where the story is being told, which I think is absolutely brilliant. And you've got mythological references to the shape-shifting. You don't know if they're brothers or if... So there's a whole pantheon worldwide of mythologies that they encapsulate in that one story, which is fantastic. Just that on its own is a story. But the application for the women in there is painful. And yes, it's jarring. I mean, that for me that little bit doesn't work. Lift that story out, put it in another book. Brilliant.
Do you know what?
In this context, no.
I don't think that's in my version. Is that in Mesolith 2? Because there is a sequel to that now. Ah,
yes.
There you go.
Yeah.
I need to get hold of that. But I think...
You too.
What's interesting in the first Mesolith as well, what I got from it was that women are basically, they're either maidens, they're mothers, or they're crones, which is, I mean, I don't know if they went for that specifically to make an archetype, to go for those archetypes, or whether it was just a slip again, because, you know, it does seem like a very limited range of things.
Well, and also it stands in quite interesting contrast to the three main men, you know, the boy, the man, and his father, and the, I guess it's a grandfather there. Because certainly at the beginning of the second book, they're portrayed as being outcasts, not outcasts, but being all broken and, you know, not perfect and very different from the rest of the tribe. How do they refer to themselves? Like hook hand, limpy and something or other. They're just very kind of they depict themselves very much as anti-heroes, and it was nice to see that, so that they, you know, they weren't all sort of prehistoric superheroes. And it's just funny that they didn't do the same with the female characters as well. I'm just trying to find
to catch you up. I completely agree with John. catch you up from Resident 2, Pim.
Yeah, I will. Yeah,
the females.
Yeah. Oh, Hooky, Limpy, and Baldy. That was it.
That's it. The female story in Elizabeth 2 is much stronger, but it's no less disconcerting. So there's a great ritual where the girls become women and paint themselves in what's called red fat, and the student's supposed to be over.
Yeah.
And it's all about getting a husband.
Right.
And they're dressing themselves up to be beautiful to get husbands. And the Star Wolf, Star Fox story that themselves too beautiful to work.
Oh.
And so therefore they're going to have starry.
Wow.
My rushing effort. So they're gonna have starry husbands, you see.
Right.
And then when that doesn't work and they realise they've still got to do things to the world. Now as an explanation for the constellation, it works beautifully. And when they're there, they meet a Venus figurine, essentially, a huge woman who is breastfeeding a pair of male twins who are giants.
Yeah.
So you've got all these mythological and constellation-related references in the story, which is great, apart from the fact that story is situated in an overriding narrative where women are, as soon as they become mature, married off, and their focus is to be married off.
Yeah, and
and that's it. That's all they do.
That's all they do.
But in the Star story, in the Star, yes, they do. But Star story talks about them needing to be able to prepare a carcass. Have you ever tried preparing a carcass with a flint? It's really hard work, incredibly physically arduous. But these women aren't considered strong enough to hunt in. Now, I'm 5'2" and 8 stone. I can hunt. I can shoot a bow and I can throw a spear.
Yeah.
I can hunt.
Yeah, absolutely.
I know I can't shoot a carcass with a flint because I've tried it. But it's way back in the book. That's a bit problematic.
It does seem a shame because I think, you know, from ethnographic parallels, it looks like in the hunter-gatherer period of the Mesolithic and earlier, there wasn't quite so much of this whole, you know, the women are only around to make babies and, you know, do the stuff at home. It was slightly more equal, and it would be nice to, I mean, I do sometimes have a problem when books about prehistory make it all too nice and everything's so good and everybody, all these women have power and there's nothing wrong going on because, you know, clearly women were treated differently in the past and that's what we're struggling against. But, when you're going to a period like the Mesolithic, where it's possible that they were treated slightly, you know, or did have some more power and more respect and did lots and lots of work, it does seem a shame to get rid of that. Anyway, so I really need to get hold of that Mesolith too. I think the first one as well does have loads of. These kind of European folk tales embedded in it, the Swan Woman, who is buried actually at Vedbæk Cemetery in Denmark, makes an appearance, and it was lovely to see her. But again, her story is a little, I suppose at least she does something. She is the shaman where she goes and gets eaten by fishes, doesn't she, as she in the story, and then she comes back to life, which is kind of a nice shamanic thing to be doing. So she has a little bit of power, but then she becomes kind of the little wife who dies in childbirth. So
to be fair, I think they pack so much into the first book in terms of quality storytelling that I certainly didn't notice any gender inequalities. It is really just, it's about Poika and what he gets up to, and it's about the stories that are told around him, whether it be about the horror of the big blue baby, the man-eating Urga, or the Swan Lord and his captive daughters, or the old woman Corpy, the Raven woman, who has elements of Baba Yaga and Eastern European myths. They pack so much into that first book that it's just swept away in the storytelling. Whereas book two has its moments. I'm not sure they're ever going to get round to a book three. Mm-hmm. I hope they do, but book one stands on its own as one of the greatest pieces of creative archaeological narrative reconstruction that I've ever read. I think it really is fantastic, and I certainly wouldn't want to worry too much about the archaeology of it or the social aspects of it, because it's just a great piece of storytelling.
I'd like to beg to differ, but we're going to take a little break right now, and then when we come back we'll argue a little bit more about this.
Telling a different story to the traditional lines of archaeology, the Anarchaeologist podcast seeks the stories and ideas that are often overlooked or not considered real archaeology. Video games, anarchism, and archaeology in the middle of hostile areas. Host Tristan doesn't search under the rocks, he destroys them. Available on iTunes every fortnight.
Hello and welcome back. Now it's getting a little bit heated, so maybe we should move on to not talking about the representation of women. But I just want to say right at the beginning of Mesolith 1, Poika says, "I don't want to stay behind whilst you go hunting. Stay behind with the women and the weak." So there you go. Anyway, I rest my case. Now, John, Matt has mentioned that quite a lot of the imagery in this is kind of from horror films, that seems to be a thing in a lot of graphic novels. Was that necessary, do you think, in this? Or I'm not saying I don't like it, but what do you think?
Well, it's fun to draw, I suppose. I think what is interesting about Mesolith is that I think in a lot of archaeological contexts, people try and keep the real, quote unquote, the real and the supernatural separate in terms of stylistic approach. Mm. And it's interesting that both in Mesolith and in Age of Bronze, both the writers and the artists have taken a completely opposite approach, which is to make the supernatural and the real in the same style. Mm. So you're never really certain whether what you're seeing is real or supernatural. Mm. And it's a very kind of anti-archaeological approach where we're very careful to separate out things which are, more plausible from things that are less plausible in our interpretations. And I think that's what makes Mesolith feel so different from most archaeological texts. Mm. Mm.
But also, is it that, we're always saying that people in the past wouldn't have separated out the real and the metaphysical quite so much as we do. Is it possibly a need to kind of show that?
Yes, I suppose so. But then if you think about it, neither do we. If all the lights go out, if the power goes, and you're stuck in a building that you don't know, you imagine all sorts of things. Yeah. And it's not just imagine them. You genuinely see them. You genuinely think that somebody is 10 feet away from you coming to get you or whatever. Yeah. So I think it's a necessary way to show that kind of feeling, which we generally don't talk about, we generally don't acknowledge. And we do put it in our horror films and so on. But, as you were saying, there's a lot of kind of horror film or horror genre imagery in the books. And I think that's their way of telling us this is that kind of moment.
Because a big blue baby that turns into a flesh-eating monster is pretty disturbing. And I wondered, does anybody have any knowledge of any traditional tales that tell about flesh-eating demon babies? Does anyone know? Erin?
I did ask my wife.
Not as I found yet.
So I wondered, because, there's some of them are clearly going to be are from traditional tales, like the Swan Woman, but some of them I wasn't so sure.
Okay. Mesolith 2 has two giant babies in it, Ken.
Does it really?
So if they do a third one, we're going to be in the triplet range. the folk stories that they've included run between Ireland and Russia. Mm. And there's this fantastic mix of Irish and Russian tales with a bit of Flemish and a bit of Dutch and a bit of Danish thrown in there, and quite a lot of Japanese, actually, with the swan archetype, even the way she's drawn and the tales that are told within that.
But also
as for the giant baby, it's the eternally hungry baby. It's almost, for me, a metaphor of what having a baby in this space is like, in that they're a darn sight bigger than they physically are, and they are perpetually hungry. So it's back to that physical, metaphysical reality twist, where the two sides blur.
Yeah.
And what appears to be is not tangible.
Yeah.
And go.
That's how I've taken it.
Going back to what
I don't know about everybody else.
Going back to what John said, I thought was that very the blue baby is then repeated throughout the books,
right?
Because that tale has clearly sunk into Poika's head, and he starts thinking. Yeah. He sees the blue baby when he's in the cave, when he's at the cliff looking at the cloud. Yeah. That blue baby has really made an impression on me as well.
Yeah, but it's a pretty scary thing. I mean, I also thought that it was a metaphor for the kind of the germs inside him, that are the infection inside him that he has to then beat when he's lying, recovering from his wound. I mean, one of the Swan Woman that we mentioned, we've talked about her quite a lot. I mean, that's also the Wayland, the Smith's tale, isn't it? So there's completely bound in. And what's interesting is that that burial is a real burial, with a young woman and a little baby that clearly died in childbirth being buried on a swan's wing. So could it be, there was some interesting historical linguistic research recently, wasn't there, that some of our fairy tales might go back all the way to the Bronze Age and even earlier. Do you think this kind of is an example of one of those?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's clearly the idea, isn't it? It's clearly the idea that as a storyteller, you want to make those kind of connections. You want to try and explore those kind of connections. And again, that's something we tend not to do in formal archaeological texts. Mm. It just seems all too, you know, subjective. But it's really nice to see somebody doing it.
I think when I commission a reconstruction drawing, I always think of there's two different ways about going about doing it. You can do the traditional archaeological reconstruction drawing, which is always based on archaeological evidence. It's demonstrating things like how people dressed. It's demonstrating the construction of buildings. Mm. It's an overview of a settlement. It's maybe how you used an artifact. And that's quite a traditional way of looking at it. But you can also have the creative narrative reconstruction, which looks at exploring place or myth, or the concept of prehistory, but in a more creative way, but that's not necessarily reconstruction. And I think we're as a discipline, we're now more happy with the idea that you can have both that interpretative, archaeological, very much demonstrating the science, and you can have that interpretive, creative narrative where you're actually trying to tell a story. And what Mezolith is to me is just a really, really high quality example of that creative narrative reconstruction, where you've said, yeah, look, it's based in archaeology, it's based in prehistory, what we know or what we think of the Mesolithic, but actually we've just let the storytellers go wild. Mm. And as long as you know that, then it's certainly something I would put into kids' hands and go, look, read that. If you want to know more, then go and read a book about the Mesolithic. But it is what it is. It's just a really, really good example.
And
but,
isn't actually that part of the problem there, is that the first kind of reconstruction you're talking about, you know, the very specific one, is the one that archaeologists use. Mm-hmm. They want to know how the tool was used or made or whatever. But it's the second kind that non-archaeologists are interested
absolutely.
In.
I'd hope to think that we're moving beyond just that rigid.
Yes, that would be very nice. But I think it's I think archaeology as a discipline still doesn't know how to make best use of those second kinds. Yes, they might, you know, we might like them as individuals, and yes, certain directors or project managers will commission them for whatever reason, but it's how do you use that? How do you actually use that in archaeology? That I think that question still hasn't really been fully answered properly, to the point where people will produce that second kind instinctively. Mm.
I know that all three of you are really working on that second kind of archaeological interpretation, either through comics or commissioning, or through your work, Erin, in poetry and so, and storytelling, and the geomythology. And but how widespread actually is it? I think that's, you know, it would be lovely if, as you say, it becomes more instinctual. But are people still afraid of commissioning and doing this kind of work?
If I could, can I jump in there? It's down, and John mentioned it earlier, it's down to money. Mm. It's mesolith is properly high caliber stuff. Mm-hmm. And to do that, you have to get the best storytellers, the best graphic novels. And to do that, you then have to lose maybe a bit of the control that most archaeologists would want in the interpretation of their site. You actually have to hand it over to the artist and just say, look, you know, get on with it.
Yeah.
We have to be honest with ourselves and say that there's interpretation, there's factual interpretation, and then there's letting the creatives get on with it.
And I think a lot more of that would be done if we could come up with...
Oh, could I come in there?
Go on, Erin.
Sorry. Facts are still facts and fiction is still fiction. For me, where there is factual data, I like to see a story stick to it, because there are enough gaps in between the facts for the fiction to run wild. So where there are details that can be anchored down into data as known at the time of creation of a piece of work, I do think that should be accurately represented. And I'm a little wary with Mesolith 2, with aspects of that, particularly in relation to the hunting of horses, which is a very contestable topic, and the way they've shown it. I can't fit any archaeological data to match the way they've shown it. And that, for me, is problematic.
I'm
very, very happy to have the blurring, that fact fiction blurring in the representation. Does that make sense?
I totally agree with you. I think if when we're looking at trying to be more creative with archaeology and with the sites or places or artifacts that we're trying to explain, we need to be very clear about the including the methodology. If you're doing archaeological reconstruction or archaeological narrative, or indeed archaeological visualization, then you have to base it in the science and have an element of the science and the methodology within that. Otherwise, you're just going into the completely creative narrative stuff, which is great. We all love it. There's an element of projects or commissioning projects or running projects that we should think about doing that, because it's what the outreach and what people really like. But I think that there's a kind of blurred zone in between I think if we were clever about it, a bit canny about it, we could get some really good work done creatively, but based on the archaeology.
Yes.
John, you were trying to say something earlier. Is that a good point?
And Mesolith 2 doesn't do that.
No.
I think
Mesolith 2 doesn't do that for me.
Yeah. Sorry, John.
I completely agree with all this. And I think one of the things that archaeology and archaeological visualizers of all kinds need to work on is a way of doing that, is a way of signaling in a work what evidence is used for what elements of it and what elements of it are based on this degree of speculation and so on, which in itself is quite a difficult thing to do.
It is. How would you approach it, John?
this is one of the things that we tried to do out at Chatelier when I was illustrator there, is exactly that, come up with a way of doing it. And the best way we could do it, the best idea I suppose we had at the time, was to try and incorporate all kinds of, you know, hovers and hyperlinks and stuff that would, in a digital image, would allow you to sort of pop windows out, a kind of primitive form of GIS. But I found that problematic, because you could still extract the image away from all that information. Mm. And that was one of the reasons why I ended up with comics, because it was much more difficult to extract the text and the sort of explanatory part of the information away from the image. Mm. So I'm still thinking that is the direction that I would head to do that kind of signposting. I'm not sure how you'd do it in other kinds of media or in other ways.
Yeah, because I've seen it in picture books for younger children, because Mesolith I wouldn't give to an age 7-year-old, who are the people studying the Stone Age in England anyway. Is to have information at the back of the book saying, oh, look, this is the real object and this is where it came from. And that's quite nice, but it does bring it back to that whole factual thing away from the story. But then how else do you do it? Do you have footnotes or something? That would really ruin it, wouldn't it?
Can I jump in?
There are lessons, I think, in the Japanese approach. Oh, sorry.
Everybody wanted to jump in on that one. Matt, we haven't heard.
Yeah.
The best archaeological creative narrative and reconstruction that I have ever seen, right, and that you need a drum roll at this point, but is Stephen Beastley, who's a really good graphic designer or illustrator. And it was way back when I was a kid, and they were the timelines of time travels with Usborne time travels with the Vikings in particular, where the kid put on a kind of time traveling helmet and would then go and float to all extents and purposes over a scene from the Viking Age, and they were creative in that there was lots going on. There's lots of people in there, whether it be attacking a monastery or building a Viking boat, but they were informative because there's lots of little, you know, captions, like John says, you actually can't disentangle the information from the narrative. It's all in there. You have to see the whole as you look at it. And I thought I always say that the Stephen Beastley Usborne were brilliant.
Sorry, Erin, you wanted to say something.
I think Mesolith, does this very well, actually. As John had said before about the way it interweaves the metaphysical with the physical and the data with the mythological, my quibble is that the data isn't always accurate data, and so then you where the information is coming from, that I do find problematic. And I have just remembered, actually, in relation to your earlier question about the blue baby, in that the color blue is generically taken to mean creation. So it's often used within creation myths to indicate the other. So Kali, Krishna, etc. That colour of indigo. So maybe there's an element of that going in with the blue babies.
Oh, that's interesting. Well, right now we have to take a quick break. I know it's getting really interesting. We'll be back in a couple of minutes.
All these things we make no apology for the study of archaeology. We don't do dinosaurs.
No. Did aliens build Stonehenge? Did the Easter Island statues walk? Did the Vikings colonize Midwest America? What does mainstream archaeology have to say about all of this? Listen to the Archaeological Fantasies podcast and learn about popular archaeological mysteries. Hoax or fact? Learn to tell the difference with Dr. Kenneth Fader and co-host Sarah of the Archie Fantasies blog. Check out the show on iTunes and Stitcher Radio and at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com/Archie Fantasies and get ready to think critically. Let's get back to the show.
Funny beady blokes, you will see, are a staple of archaeology.
Hi, and we're back again. So we're quite having quite a lot of discussion over this Mesolith book, which is may or may not be set in the Mesolithic, with the use of its evidence from all over the place, or not all, or lack of evidence of its where it's created the ideas. Now, we were talking about whether or not these books need to be grounded more in evidence, where the evidence exists. But part of the of what I like about Mesolith, and I think you mentioned it before, Matt, about how he ends up, it's supposed to be set in Britain, but he ends up in Lascaux for some reason. And then possibly Chauvet Cave as well in the south of France, where there's all the handprints, or at least the hand negatives on the wall. There are other caves that have those handprints, not so much in Lascaux, I don't think. Obviously, you've got the Danish stuff coming in, and you've and Erin, you've talked about all the different myths coming from all over the place. Matt, you did say you'd be happy to give this to a child and say, read that and then find out something else, you know, read something. A proper book. Well, you didn't. No, I'm putting words into your mouth. You didn't say a proper book about the Mesolithic.
I did kind of. I think that these are really, really interesting books because of what they say about us as archaeologists. Mm. We can't tell Ben Haggerty and Adam Brockbank how to display the Mesolithic.
No, no.
They're telling story using the Mesolithic as a set. And they're doing a really good job of it.
And I think
what we lack, what we're not very good at as a discipline, is picking up on that kind of creative angle and actually funding it properly to deliver our own aims. So we wait for TV to turn up and film our sites and then moan that they're not doing it properly. Or we wait for the press, maybe we put a press release about something and we moan that the press don't cover it properly. If we want to do it properly, we have to put in money and time and investment in terms of resources, in terms of producing similar high quality visuals, similar high quality stories that speak to a wider range of people than maybe just the archaeological enthusiast, and delivers more than just the interpretation panel on site, which is always the lowest common denominator. And that's what really gets me, that you know, we can tell a tale when it's delivered in three small paragraphs that get progressively more detailed, because we know that most people just stop reading after the first paragraph and look at the picture. I think we have to take the challenge that's been thrown down by something like Mesolith and say that this is a great way of delivering archaeological methodology and information, as well as the story that comes out of it in terms of prehistory, but to do that and to retain control, and I'm beginning to rant. We have to try and do it.
And I know you're very committed to commissioning this kind of work, and you've produced lovely stuff. Sorry, Erin.
I mean, some of us are doing this. There's no shortage of people capable of doing it. The problem, as you were stressing, is funding, and that the funding consistently comes from the science side. And I mean, I get up as a matter of course, but people look horrified when they realize they've got to pay for poetry, they've got to pay for artwork, they've got to pay for cartoons, they've got to pay for theater, they've got to pay for film. They're quite happy to pay me to go and put in a borehole or take people on a science walk. And that's a cultural issue to do with finance and where we place importance. It's not a lack of skill set within the discipline.
I agree. There are some amazingly creative people out there.
Yeah, I think the discipline actually has got these skills.
Yeah, I mean, definitely. All the people, most of the people.
We're just not funded. to use them.
And most of the people I've talked to on this podcast and many people I've met elsewhere in archaeology have got so many amazing skills and doing some brilliant stuff, like you, Erin, and like, for instance, the team Build and Burn, Kenneth Brophy and Gavin McKenzie doing their brilliant events where they build something and then burn it. Massive event. It's absolutely great. Your comics, John, and Katie Whitaker we talked to, and Hannah Sackett doing some lovely comic illustrations as well. I take my hat off to all illustrators, actually. I just think you tell a story in so many brilliant ways. But John, there is this issue, isn't there, where artists are supposed to give their work for free for some reason.
Yes. I think particularly where the sciences are involved, we're the second rung on the ladder or the second tier or whatever, there's always this sense that it's not quite as important as the science, as I was saying. And it puts a lot of people off, and it puts a lot of people within the discipline taking those skills that they have or those ideas that they have any further than just, you know, a particular level. And that's why I think internally archaeology will always struggle to produce something like Mesolith, just as I think unfortunately archaeology struggles to produce really good quality 3D computer graphics, for the same reason that it's just not seen as important enough for people to get the funding and the training and the opportunities to move beyond a certain level.
But I work with the public all the time, and with children, and
because we have to eat.
Absolutely.
Just a little.
And you know, a bit of bread and water. But you have amazing skills, and which you've spent,
not each other either.
Spent years and years developing and honing, and you know, it's an amazing thing that needs to be well rewarded. I mean, when I talk to children and other people, families, and that's my main audience when I'm not on the podcast, going out and actually talking to people, it's this kind of stuff that they really engage with and really want, because you're not going to. Nobody's going to go out there and read an archaeological report. And I read the reports and I make them interesting to people when I meet them, and pick out the really cool stuff. And I wish that it was more possible to, as you say, to put more money into 3D reconstructions and comics and great TV shows and things like that. How do we go forward with this? Can we put something together to some kind of funding bid for something or other? Come on.
I think it really has to start from the ground up, from the grassroots up.
And
go on, John.
Oh, at TAG this year, we had the Citations Cafe, and people were showing all sorts of really interesting visualization projects they were working on. There was this general agreement in the discussion that one of the things that is lacking in archaeology is not, one of the problems that has happened in archaeology is not de-skilling in terms of visualization, which is a buzz phrase or an idea that's been kicking around for about 15 years, but a general lack of visual awareness. It doesn't even go as far as the skills, it stops at awareness. And it feels like too many people within archaeology don't treat visualization as important for anything. Mm-hmm. So that's why you have these dreadful PowerPoint lectures where, you know, people just read from slides. Or that's why if you're working in as an art editor in a journal, you get maps that you can't read. Because, you know, I mean, I think it's less the skills and more just the appreciation that visualization is important.
Erin, you were going to say something.
Yeah, can I come in there? I completely and utterly agree with John. Yes. But then from working outside of the academy, it's getting the tourist groups, the councils, the galleries, etc., to work with experts to check the data that they're using, because money is being put into eye beacons. It's being put into reconstructions. Mm. It's just they're not being fact-checked. And so you computer graphics and you look at them and you go, but the sea wasn't there. Why is the sea there? Nobody thought to consult an archaeologist. And I see this again and again and again. And even when we go to the meetings and say, we will do this for free, they still don't use us. And so the problem is more than just within the profession of archaeology. It's outside of it, and the view that archaeology, the way people view archaeology
from the outside,
a non-archaeological
perspective. That's really interesting.
It isn't given the level of respect, whereas they'll get a mathematician to check something. You know, they'll get a historian sometimes to check things, but they don't listen to the archaeologists. How do we change that?
So, I mean, really, that's the opposite of what we're talking about, isn't it? It's almost like there's two problems in that the archaeologists are not engaging with visualization very well, and different ways of showing their evidence, but also the people who are doing that are not talking to the archaeologists. So we really need to form some kind of forum where we can all get together and chat.
Can I just give an example of the only example I know, actually, of where that boundary was really successfully crossed? There's a classicist at Nottingham called Stephen Hodkinson, and he was called in as the advisor on a graphic novel called 300, which was about the Spartans. Sorry, not 300, three, which was a graphic novel sort of to counter the over-the-topness of 300. And he so much enjoyed his experience working as an advisor to a top-level writer and artist team that he decided to start creating his own graphic novel or his own graphic informational material about Sparta. But he is very much and I'm sure he wouldn't mind me describing him so, he's very much an old-school classicist. You know, he looks like an old-school classicist, he dresses like an old-school classicist, he has the eye and the mind for detail of an old-school classicist, but at the same time, he also somehow understands that it is important for him to communicate well with an audience outside academia, and he's doing a fantastic job. I mean, he does a lot of public lectures, and now he's interested in comics. So I think it is possible, and I think people like him need to be brought into the fold to ask, what made you jump across the line? You know, what made you cross that boundary? What made you see this kind of art-based outreach as important? As an example.
And what would you say, John, to people who are wanting to actually get into comic?
Yeah, I mean, it is possible.
Sorry, Erin. What to get into comic creation? What would you say? Any advice?
Read a lot of comics. I think the first thing to do is to make yourself familiar with the medium. So yeah, reading a lot of comics is important. But also, as we've been talking about, think about how your data can be translated into a story without leaving any of that data behind. I think it's possible, but I don't think you necessarily need to go to the scale that Mieslith does. Actually, it's quite interesting that Mieslith is written in a series of chapters, each one is a sort of standalone story. If you have a particularly interesting burial or a particularly interesting artifact or a particularly interesting sequence of events in a trench, you can turn that into a story without necessarily having to have, you know, a beginning, middle, and end from the Neolithic all the way up until the Industrial Revolution. You know, it's not necessary to do that kind of grand narrative. You can make these little snapshot portrait, sort of postcard type things.
Erin, sorry, I interrupted you.
I think I forgot what I was going to say. I completely agree with John. And actually, you saying that at TAG was a boon to me, because it made me realise I didn't have to drawing and writing an entire novel. I could think about drawing and writing individual stories. And that made the whole concept suddenly so much more attainable. But there are lots of people who are availing themselves of, you know, tourist boards and TV groups and schools, etc., in this advisory capacity. But what I keep experiencing is that we're there, we go to the meetings, we give the information, we offer the advice, but then we get overruled on the, oh, but this looked pretty, route.
Can I jump in? We were following the story.
I think that did
Yes, but you're now giving the wrong information.
And I think that did certainly happen to Stephen, and he gave a very interesting presentation about it. And I think that's what then made him realize that if he wanted to have less of those kind of moments, he had to take charge of the whole process himself. So he went out and found an artist.
Yeah. So Matt, we have to put ourselves out there. We have to do it.
If you want to do it properly, you've got to do it yourself. But the problem is that to get the quality of somebody like Meslith, Ben Haggerty, Adam Broadbent, even 300, which I will stand by as an exceptionally great piece of storytelling in terms of Bronze Age Greece. It's impossible. It's impossible for us to do it, but we can aim high, but we have to do it ourselves. So it's not about offering ourselves up to others to help advise or to... It is about making sure that the importance of visualization within archaeology is always front and center within any project or any book, any booklet, in any interpretation. It's the images that count, and it's the storytelling behind the images, and it's the information that backs up that storytelling. And it's about that conscious decision about whether you want to do it creatively and you want to make it very clear that this is imagination, this is fiction, or you're doing it trying to be more factual about it and you're trying to be more a construction based on evidence, in which case it's all about the caption. But going back to what folk have said earlier on, visualization is absolutely key to archaeology and to, in terms of, to talking about archaeology, what we think about what we found. We can do it textually, where we're just talking to ourselves. We do it by illustration, by visualization, we're bringing in the wider audience. We have to put in money. You have to put in resource, time and effort. And it's shocking if as a discipline, we've lost that. Because we used to have it. It used to be front and center of many many archaeological publications. It was that plan, the beautiful plan right at the start, or the reconstruction drawing at the end. Visualization is key, and we have to keep pushing that.
Yeah. Yes. And with Mesolith, I think that because of the beautiful visualization, and the format of the book and the quality of it, it's really kind of bringing that archaeology to new audiences that will not necessarily have thought about that period or this or archaeology or prehistory or any of that at all. Now, sadly, we've got to bring to this podcast to an end. It's gone so quickly because we've been just constant back and forth. It's been brilliant talking to you and arguing with you. Thank you very much, everybody. I knew that you'd be a great set of guests. So can I say thank you very much to Erin for soldiering through. You didn't cough once, Erin.
Muting the mic is a wonderful thing.
Well done. Thank you.
So thank you for having me.
Thank you. And thank you very much, John. It's been brilliant to talk to you.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Matt. You did rant a little bit, but that we love that. Absolutely love that.
Good.
No, don't apologise. I think that we all know how to contact all of you, and I will put links to your Twitter or websites in the show notes if people want to contact you and ask you to do some work, or maybe in Matt's case, ask you for money. That'll be really good. Thank you. And
fund us.
Is now the time I should sing It's the Age of Austerity to the
Aquarius. Yes. Yes.
Yes.
Well, maybe not after June the 8th. Who knows? But let's not get political or any more political. So thank you so much. It's been really good fun. Tune in to the next episode of Prehistories, where I'm going to be talking to Jane Brain and Andrew Fitzpatrick about a new book that Jane has both drawn and written, because it is a graphic novel, really. Yes, it is. Yeah. It's about the Amesbury Archer. She was the first person to ever draw the Amesbury Archer, and now she's drawn his life. So that should be a really, really interesting one as well. So I hope that you tune in for that one, and thank you very much for listening today.
This show is produced by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle, and was edited by Chris Webster.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.